As I was getting out, I actually wrote an article that got published about strongly considering the use of obesity pharmacotherapy in the active duty population. Because at that time, as I was one of the, apparently the leaders in obesity medicine in the military, it was an issue, right? Active duty, we're not allowed to be on these medications for unclear reasons, because they end up getting medications for complications of obesity, but not for the actual underlying issue itself.
Welcome back, Leg Tech Nation. We got a good one for you guys today. I know a few of you are looking forward to it. But before we can get there, I had to pull Drew off of the golf course to record this intro. That's always the struggle with getting Drew's time, is competing with either golf, girl dad, or cooking.
Baking or
work.
Cooking.
Work is rarely a conflict. No. But golf, girl dad, and baking are all much more frequent conflicts. But on this particular trip to the golf course, Drew had some.
I had a story.
I don't know what to call it. Exciting interaction, just a story to share. What do you want to call it?
It's So there I was. So real quick, if people out there are in the golf YouTube space at all, you'll be familiar with how that sort of caught fire, and you know you have a tendency now to see people walking around on golf courses with cameras. So there I was, 17th green, playing great, out of my mind, putting on the green. I see this old dude in a cart cut across the fairway, and he has a camera with him, and he pulls up to the tee box next to me for the 18th hole, and he gets out, and I can see he's coming over to talk to me. I'm like, great, this is going to be a blast. Not in any rush. Most of the folks that play at my local course are a little bit older, and you end up having this sort of small talk quite a bit. So he's chatting with me. I see a website on his hat. I'm not going to say the website, no free sponsors or no free ads. I see the website, I see the camera. I'm like, this guy's a content creator, sick. So me being me, as I'm finishing up on the green and he goes ahead and plays 18, I'm thinking, okay, you know, he must be pretty good. Proceeds to just shank it into the woods. And then as I'm following him on that hole, proceeds to then just like, you know, sort of smack it out of the woods onto the green. And then here's the kicker. So I'm walking up to my drive, which I smoked, obviously. And he is on the green putting with his camera behind him, and he misses the putt like five or six times and just pulls the ball back, goes through his routine, does it again, misses, pulls the ball back, goes through, does it again. So, you know, shocker, this should surprise nobody. He's clearly just like trying to make the putt over and over again for his content. Finally makes it. I step up to my ball to hit. I'm about to swing. I notice that he's not done. He's now filming his outro. Talking into his camera before getting into his cart to leave. So finally I finish, I get home, pull up his website. Dude's a golf instructor with a YouTube page. Go to his YouTube page, watch a couple of his videos. A month prior, he had played the same course, and he steps up to the 10th hole. If people are familiar with golf, there's sort of a front nine and a back nine. And this was his back nine video of the course that we had just played. And he's talking, he's like, oh, yeah, you know, just finished up the front nine, shot one under par. Like, get out of town, bro. I just watched you shoot like a 12 on one of these holes. You're not one under par. So that's basically the end of the story. But that was how I ended my day on the golf course, with an absolute flamboyant content creator, just, you know, not filming his extra strokes and claiming a one under par. So I myself shot 32 under par today. I only counted a handful of the strokes, which is apparently how we do things around here. So anyway, yeah, that's my story. And who are we talking to today?
It has nothing to do with golf. That's the end of the golf discussion, as sad as it makes Drew.
Today we'll be back.
We have a highly anticipated episode for you guys today. This is, I would call this the Ozempic episode, the GLP-1 episode, whatever you want to call it. And we needed to bring on a qualified guest for this one. So we got Dr. Carl Nadolski. He is a clinical endocrinologist and chief of the Endocrinology, Obesity, and Diabetes Department for Holland Hospital in Holland, Michigan. He's also an assistant clinical professor of medicine for Michigan State University. He holds board certification in internal medicine, diabetes, endocrinology and metabolism, and obesity medicine. He graduated from Michigan State University in 2003 with a degree in kinesiology. He wrestled there, which you'll hear a little bit about in the episode, but he earned academic All-American, four-time All-Big Ten scholar athlete, four-time NCAA qualifier honors with the wrestling team, And he stayed on 1 year after graduation as a strength and nutrition coach for the wrestling team. He graduated from Nova Southeastern Osteopathic Medicine in 2008 and completed residency in internal medicine in Portsmouth, Virginia, graduating in 2011 and earning certification from the American Board of Internal Medicine. His bio doesn't specifically state this, but I think by that time he was in uniform with the Navy. Following residency, Dr. Nadolski practiced for 2 years as a general internist and implemented a comprehensive obesity program at Naval Medical Center Portsmouth and earned certification from the American Board of Obesity Medicine in 2012. He did his fellowship training in endocrinology at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center in Bethesda, Maryland, earning board certification in 2015. Following fellowship, he developed and directed the Diabetes, Obesity, and Metabolic Institute, was faculty for the Endocrinology Fellowship Program, and assistant professor of medicine for the Uniformed Services University, which, if you're not familiar, is the DOD's medical school. That's why we brought him on, because he had the background in obesity and a little bit of a background in the military as well, served 9 years in the Navy. To wrap it up, let's see, he is currently serving as the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists chair for the Obesity Stigma Consensus Statement and Comprehensive Obesity Management Algorithm, co-authored the 2016 Clinical Practice Guidelines for Comprehensive Medical Care of Patients with Obesity, and lead author of the AACE's 2023 Consensus Statement Addressing Stigma and Bias in the Diagnosis and Management of Patients with Obesity. And one I added to his bio because he left it off of the one he sent to us, and I think it's an important detail. He is one half of the Docs Who Lift duo. He and his brother Spencer, who is also an MD specializing in obesity, or DO, I don't actually know whether he's an MD or DO, but he's a doctor specializing in obesity, co-host an excellent podcast, Docs Who Lift, and they're both very active on social media, sharing information around obesity, weight loss, stuff like that. We will absolutely link to all their stuff in the show notes.
If you guys have paid any attention to the news lately, you will have heard or perhaps even seen some stuff on Ozempic. I had seen it actually coming across Spotify podcast recommendations for a while, and I never really knew what it was until we were prepping for this episode. And lo and behold, again, if you're sort of aware of what's going on in the medical space, it is quite the hotness these days when it comes to weight loss. So it was, for me, a really, I think, fascinating episode, because I came into this with my own thoughts and maybe even biases about weight loss, having kind of grown up in the human performance space and just sort of thinking like, you know, train harder, eat less, et cetera, et cetera. But I think we have some really appropriate and fascinating discussions about how that whole thing actually works. So an exciting episode, and definitely one that I think will appeal to a lot of folks listening.
This is a topic that several of you have requested, or it's come up on social media posts that you've shared with me and things like that. Like Drew said, I think in the fitness world, it's easy to default to an assumption that these people just need more discipline, or they need to work on their diet.
Well, and in the military world.
Absolutely. I think there's a lot of overlaps between fitness world and military world.
We brought that up too with them. Just the idea of like, I mean, stereotypical, you know, senior NCO, well, just work harder. It's like, well, sometimes it's not that easy.
And you hear it when he talks about it. He started out with that kind of preconception too. You already heard it. He grew up as an athlete, all that kind of stuff. But we'll dive in a little bit on obviously the endocrinology, the hormone stuff here, the background science, what we're learning about these drugs, and paint a little bit of a more nuanced picture.
Enjoy. Hey guys, before we kick this episode off, just wanted to give a quick plug to the two options that we have for folks interested in training with us. We have the team-based Long and Strong program. And then if you are interested in a more engaging, intensive, more tailored option, we offer one-on-one coaching as well.
And you can find both of those on the training tab of our website, mopsandmos.com. And if it's the team training you're interested, click that link and you will find a 1 week free trial.
So again, if any of the things that we talk about on this podcast are interesting to you as far as training goes, head to the website, like Alex just mentioned, select that training tab and follow the instructions from there. Enjoy the episode. I want to start this with a dumb question. and it could be ignorant, but I think you're the guy of all the people I've come across. I think you might be the guy that can answer this question for me. And I, for context, I want my mind to be changed here because I realize that I'm probably in the minority. But so through, like, maybe this is through a military lens with the Army, it's ABCP. I'm assuming every branch has a sort of, like, you know,
this is the first time Drew used an acronym that I had to fill in. Army Body Composition Program.
Army Body Composition.
Oh, okay.
Forgive me. But every branch, right, has this sort of program where they, you know, if you're a certain BMI or whatever. And I know that the predominant mindset in the military and probably culturally is that if you are overweight, you just need to work harder. It's a lifestyle thing. Do better. Extra PT. We're just going to blast you. You know, and having spent my whole career in human performance, I've seen, you know, if you exercise more and eat healthier, you will lose weight. But then there's also this sort of tangential conversation about obesity specifically as an epidemic, where we're looking at pharmaceuticals, Ozempic we'll go into, and that kind of thing. So from where you sit and with your background and your expertise, convince me that it isn't just do better, work harder, eat healthier.
Yeah. So we have a lot of data to show that there are a complex variety of genetic factors, first of all, that sort of dictate a person's ultimate energy balance regulation system. And our energy balance regulation system is way more complex than we once used to think, and still not enough people quite understand it. And it's hard to articulate, but we have an area in our brain, the hypothalamus, that controls a lot of different things that you don't have to think about. But one of the things it controls is our appetite, metabolism, some cravings, our satiety, and it communicates with peripheral signals from our body's fat stores. You know, that's the leptin hormone that's become somewhat famous in the last 25 years or so, but also signals from our intestines, like the ghrelin hunger hormone from the gut, the GLP-1 and GIP, which we're going to talk about because they've been made into pharmaceuticals, from our small intestine, a bunch of other hormones, a bunch of neurologic control. And then there are other parts of the brain, like our hedonic part of our brain, like the dopamine responses and the addiction type neuroendocrine signals. And then you combine that in the fact that we live in this obesogenic environment, right? So obesity is more now. It's a problem now. Our genetics didn't suddenly just change, but our environment sure changed. And then we have all sorts of other triggers that throw a monkey wrench into that complex energy balance regulation system. And then everyone has a different genetic predisposition, right? And then you throw in other issues like medical issues, stressors, childhood trauma, maybe poor, just straight up poor lifestyle as growing up. What you hear about, like food deserts, availability of appropriate quality food. So there's this over consumption of high calorie, hypercalorically dense food. People have different medications. There are athletes who are used to eating a ton of calories just to keep up with their demands, and then they get an injury, and then they develop obesity because that regulation system doesn't adjust. And it's kind of like one of the best analogies I've heard is from an expert friend of mine at Yale, who describes it as a thermostat of a house. Right. So you have the thermostat trying to regulate the temperature, but pretend you have a broken thermostat, and then it's keeping people at a body weight that's not so healthy if they've developed obesity. And by obesity, I mean excessive or abnormally distributed adipose tissue that at least has the risk of, if not already causing, the health problems that we actually care about. Right. And, you know, in the military or performance wise, that could be just physical performance, you know, wartime, you know, war fighters or athletes. You know, there's obviously that role, but then in my world, it's health problems, and that can range from mental health. We have a lot of internalized weight bias and stigma and depression that is a vicious cycle with obesity. And then certainly the cardiometabolic health that is pretty much popular, you know, like ranging from insulin resistance to diabetes, heart disease risk, fatty liver, all that stuff, but also biomechanical stuff. So like sleep apnea is kind of like a combination of metabolic and biomechanical problems, and sleep itself is a vicious cycle. And then, of course, like knee arthritis and these things. And even if you're truly, truly healthy with excess, like adipose tissue and obesity, you have an increased risk of cancer. And it looks like cancer can be reduced with appropriate measures to reduce the weight. And, you know, and we have tons and tons of studies showing that despite really good intensive nutrition exercise efforts, if you have a good response, that, you know, the metabolism maybe isn't quite what it should be for some people. Appetite goes up, cravings go up, and ultimately body weight often goes up. That's why, and then the media goes crazy, right? And they say, I guess nobody can lose weight and maintain it. Well, that's not totally true, but there's a lot of truth to it in our current environment. And why, when we study these medications that you're going to talk about that have really, really good results, when that therapeutic trigger is taken away, the body's biology then really drives weight regain despite the people's continued efforts.
Hmm. So, I mean, and I asked this because we just earlier this week talked to Dr. Mozafarian, and he's doing a lot of the food as medicine stuff with the Tufts Clinic. And
Darius.
He walked us through really the history of kind of the industrial food system that we're dealing with now. And so I guess as a follow on to my question, is it genetically, you know, mental health, all these things, is it that that has always been there, but we've just been able to get around some of that because we weren't dealing with high calorie foods, you know, all of the things that we're dealing with now, or is that something changed?
Kind of. Well, in a very simplified manner, I mean, something changed. That's, we have a much higher processed, refined food environment. We do have availability of excessively high calorie, calorie dense, nutrient poor foods. The cost of that is, there's an imbalance of the costs and availability for people. And then it's, you know, and also more sedentary behavior. Right. So non-exercise activity, in addition to the more sort of obvious exercise, which is really good for weight maintenance or prevention of obesity, but not necessarily for treatment either, by the way. And so and then you can talk about other things that, that also contribute. There are endocrine disrupting chemicals now that we're learning about, you know, the Endocrine Society, an organization I'm a member of. There's a lot of research going on with, you know, the different phthalates and the plastics and all these different things that are causing problems. It's hard to know what to say to do about it, other than maybe try to avoid, you know, microwaving your stuff in plastic things. But those play a role. If you listen to, there are good talks about some of the other data showing things like viruses that seem to be part of the problem. There are certain viruses that seem to trigger obesity. So there was a great talk a year ago by a guy who's been studying this stuff, you know, forever. He is one of the guys that talked about viral triggers. And, you know, and everyone was kind of like, what the heck are you talking about? That's kind of like so way out there. But it's like you can't argue with the data, you know, and it's not like everyone's the same either. So he talks about obesities, plural, like all sorts of different causes, you know, different triggers in our environment these days, on top of the variety of genes that people have. So there are some very specific genes, we call those monogenic genes, that have to do with that control in the hypothalamus that I was talking about. And people probably don't want to hear about the fine details of how that works, but there are some where it causes an absolute disruption of like the hunger or the satiety signals. And those are relatively rare, and those are seen in like little kids who have severe obesity, and they're always hungry. And there's usually something else going on. You know, there's developmental delays and all these different things. But then there's some variety of syndromes. You may have heard of like Prader-Willi, that's a syndrome. There's something called Bardet-Biedl that's maybe more common than we used to think, where it causes some of those disruptions up there. But then most people have what we call polygenic. So there's all sorts of different varieties of genetic risks that go into it. Most of those also have studies that show with appropriate nutrition, fitness, exercise, kind of from cradle to grave, despite the genetic risk, we can at least prevent significant obesity from occurring. But again, we can't always prevent all these different triggers in our environment. And so, you know, the extremes that you hear out there are not what we should listen to. The people who say, nope, it's only diet and exercise and everyone should be able to lose weight and it's no big deal. Well, that's wrong. That's definitively wrong. We have even just simple twin studies that have been done forever, you know, like twins that are raised apart and they both end up in with obesity, despite one having a healthy lifestyle and one not, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like those are, we have plenty of those data to that are relatively easy to notice. But then on the other hand, yeah, we have to improve our environment somehow. That's a bigger picture issue. But on an individual basis, we got to help people improve their personalized nutrition. Minimally processed refined food automatically helps change that energy intake. Obviously, more non-exercise physical activity, more exercise, considering medications that people are put on that disrupt that balance and, all sorts of other little factors that we can individualize for people.
Mm-hmm.
So we're kind of laying a long answer here.
No, that was. I'm glad you went that long because I don't want to sit here and be the guy who's like, well, if you just work out and like eat healthier, because like you said, I know that's definitively wrong.
And I will tell you that I used to think that, right? Yeah. I grew up, so I am fortunate to have had parents who had good, genetic body composition type bodies, but they were also, relatively healthy eating, physically active people. My dad, I'm built a lot like my dad. My dad was, lean and muscular when he was in his 20s and people say, oh my God, great genetics, obviously, but he was working at it his whole childhood through adulthood into later age. And so was I. So we started really early. I mean, I was working out when I was a little kid. We had at least an awareness. He was a biology teacher. So we talked a lot about nutrition science. We enjoyed our treats and we called them quadruple bypass burgers at the fast food restaurants and stuff. But we knew what we were doing and we're like, yeah, we can get away with that once in a while because we're working out so well. And we, even if we didn't quite understand it, we knew we had a little bit of a genetic benefit that we could get away with those things with our workout and otherwise good diet. And a lot of people can, but then a lot of people fall prey to our environment and it just overwhelms their body's ability to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone's different.
So I want to keep kind of building this foundation of background information before we dive into some of these medications and stuff. A common data point that's thrown around, well, a couple of data points that are thrown around is that like overweight and obesity is the largest single factor that prevents people from being eligible to join the military. The latest information is that like approaching 70% of active military personnel are at least in the overweight category. Over 20% are in the obese category, and that's all determined by BMI. So I do want to have a quick conversation about the utility of BMI as a screening tool. I mean, there is a possibility that too much of the military are just elite bodybuilders and that's our real problem and we're just missing it in the data, but I just want to hear your take on BMI.
Well, and certainly that's another thing where if you would have asked me, 15 years ago when I was active duty, I would have really raged against that machine because my BMI has always been overweight, at least, if not knocking on the door of obesity. But even so, I help out with some, national guidelines for this stuff. And we're actually working on another one now to update this. And it's for many years, we have been trying to articulate that BMI is not a diagnostic criteria for an individual. It's very good for population studies that correlates to adipose tissue, obviously, and that correlates to the diseases that come from excess adipose tissue. So that's how that happened. That's where those, that's how the BMIs got used for medical purposes. There's some interesting history going back to the, insurance companies and health insurance. I mean, there's some people who even, have some concerns about sort of a racist component to it, but we're not going to get into that right now. But it's very well established that it is not appropriate to diagnose somebody with obesity based on a BMI alone. But I, as a physician, especially one who, does this stuff, I can easily look at most BMIs and look at a person and say, yeah, that's consistent with obesity. I can just look at them and know it, right? But to refine it a little bit more individually, we can do a waist circumference. So that's talking about specifically abdominal obesity. There are people who have excess body fat, but it's distributed in a little bit more metabolically healthy manner, more or less kind of a female shape, right? The pear shape versus the apple shape. And that just has to do with how well your peripheral adipose cells function, essentially. And it's healthy if you store it elsewhere. When you start storing it abdominally, that's not healthy metabolically. but a waist circumference, and we have criteria for that that can help us sort of diagnose abdominal obesity because of the risk that's then associated with diabetes, fatty liver, heart disease, et cetera. So that can help refine it. But just a good clinical exam saying, does this BMI fit with a person's clinical adipose tissue? But then even more importantly, actually, so in the real medical realm of obesity, then it's we should stage the severity of it. So, and that gets into the complications. So do they have any complications like high blood pressure, diabetes, sleep apnea, knee arthritis, fatty liver? Or are they truly, truly, truly healthy? So they might have excess adipose tissue, but they are physically fit. And they feel well and they don't have mental issues and all that stuff. But pretty much if you start getting above a BMI of 30 and especially 35, there's nothing else other than guys who are maybe abusing steroids and are professional bodybuilders. And then we have other health problems to deal with. Yeah. So that's not healthy either. So it almost doesn't matter except that they just have a different diagnosis.
So, last question on kind of the language we use around this mm-hmm. issue. We've seen plenty of headlines and things like that describing obesity as an epidemic. And I kind of just want your take on the use of that term, whether it fits. Really, the question here is, can you have an epidemic of a disease that's non-communicable?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think by the definition of it. I mean, I guess we could review the definitions of those things. You know, like we had to do that a few years ago for something, COVID, a pandemic and epidemic. I think it's appropriate. Maybe we need to, get an epidemiologist to confirm that for us. But yeah, I think so. Just because it's not communicable I don't think that plays a role. You know, it's a problem across the globe. And it's,
I think, and again, this is me throwing up my ignorant flag again, but like when I hear epidemic, I think of like Ebola, right? And I think of something that is just like, like you said, communicable, out of control. What are we going to do? And I go back.
But it is out of control.
No, and that's the thing.
It is globally out of control. So it's, exactly. Especially in the United States and then unfortunately kind of globally now. So it is. Yeah.
And that's kind of the question that I wanted to get out with this is maybe a little bit of a tangent, perhaps, but like, where are we starting? Are we starting to see this become more prevalent in other countries, other regions of the globe? Because I know for so long it has been a quote unquote Western disease. And we talk about the spread of the quote unquote Western diet. And with that comes all this other stuff. But what is kind of the global conversation around it right now?
Yeah, no, it is. It is. Like, I mean, if you looked it up, like on the World Health Organization or something. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And without a question, it's, and we've become a more global world.
I like that. We've become a global world.
Yeah. If that's not a double, I don't know if that would, you know what I mean? Like, what do they call it? We've become.
No, I know what you're saying.
You know what I mean?
I can't think of the word.
There's a term for it.
Yeah. I'll share it just because Drew was asking it. But the United States is not the number one country in terms of obesity globally anymore. There are several countries that are worse. Yeah. I mean, Mexico has passed the United States.
Is that like a per capita or just pure?
Yeah. I mean, according to Dr. Google, the number one fattest country, which I don't think anybody wants to hear that. But Nauru, it's a small remote Pacific island, and like 9 in 10 people on that island are overweight.
That actually makes sense from a little bit of what I know. And then that also then gets into some other nuance, by the way. So speaking of genetics and ethnicities, there are ethnic differences in how we distribute. I was talking about distributing peripherally or in our abdomen, etc. So there's some ethnicities who at any given BMI just absolutely store more, say in their abdominal area, their visceral adiposity, liver, pancreas, etc., putting them at higher risk of diabetes and heart disease. For example, Asians and even like South Americans have that. So like they actually have obesity at lower BMIs per se. Mm-hmm. And lower waist circumference, actually. So, because again, it's about the disease process of it. It's not just weight.
So, and this is one of those $1 million questions where if anybody had the answer to this, we'd have $1 million. But given, you've been in the military, you've been around the military, and we're in a place right now, at least from what I can say on the Army side, where conversations are starting to happen where we might combine a pharmaceutical approach with a lifestyle approach, and what would it look like to prescribe sort of quote unquote fat loss medication to soldiers that meet certain criteria. So given, again, kind of given where you're at now and with what you know, what would you handed the keys to the castle to sort of reimagine the military's, I guess we could call it weight loss program, what would that look like to you?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. So if you look up, are you guys familiar with the Military Medicine Journal by any chance? There's a journal of military medicine. There's a journal of military medicine. As I was getting out, I actually wrote an article that got published about strongly considering the use of obesity pharmacotherapy in the active duty population. Because at that time, as I was one of the, apparently the leaders in obesity medicine in the military, it was an issue, right? Active duty, we're not allowed to be on these medications for unclear reasons, because they end up getting medications for complications of obesity, but not for the actual underlying issue itself. And for any disease that has anything to do with obesity or anything else that has anything to do with nutrition, exercise, sleep, anything we can do with lifestyle, those things are always absolutely first line and mandatory and the foundation of everything we do. But it's easier said than done to make that happen. And so, my argument was based upon physiology, pathophysiology, and the safety and efficacy, meaning the benefits of these medications to help people, including active duty soldiers and sailors and airmen, to achieve healthy, fit warfighting ability, levels of body composition. It's still military. It's still, warfighting capability type stuff. So, we have to have capable warfighters. Mm-hmm.
So you've set us up really well for a transition into the conversation we brought you on here for, to talk about some of these medications, pharmaceuticals, the different tools that are now getting tons of coverage in the news and things like that. So I think first I want to ask you to kind of orient us to what's out there in terms of pharmaceuticals for obesity, weight loss, things like that. Yeah, just take
well,
it
I'll go, there, yeah. So I'll go back a little bit of time. I won't, nobody wants to hear the whole history of these medications.
We had a 2.5 hour episode with somebody talking about the history of physical culture.
I have time for that.
Don't shy away.
So not that long ago, when I was still active duty, it was sort of the new dawn of these medications, because while I was in residency and then going into fellowship, we had approval of some new medications that had what we might think of now as modest, but important clinical benefits. So phenermine is a medication that's been around forever. It's like been the one tried and true appetite suppressant that's been around. It has a hint of amphetamine-like properties, but it's not an amphetamine. And it works up in the area that hypothalamus I was talking about and just works on reducing appetite. The problem is it's been around for so long and it was thought to be like an amphetamine. It's a scheduled drug. So it's a scheduled three drug and only approved technically for 3 months at a time, which is, as it turns out, inappropriate, but that's just the way that goes, but it ended up being approved in combination with a medication called topiramate. And the branded name of this is Qsymia. So it's a phenermine topiramate extended release formulation studied and ultimately approved for chronic use. This was approved back in, something like 2012 or something. I don't know. It's been a while. I can't even remember. But it has pretty good benefits. Every medication has its pros and cons, potential little side effects. We were using it in a little bit in active duty. Sometimes we had to get like special policies and stuff like that, including phenermine and then the stuff called Qsymia. And so that's been around and is still available. There was another one that was approved around a similar time, a little bit after it. That's a combination of a couple other medications that have been around for a long time. One of them is bupropion, commonly known as Wellbutrin for depression. It's also used for smoking cessation. It's called Zyban. And this works up in the area of the brain. It works on dopamine and norepinephrine up there. And it's a reuptake inhibitor. So you have more of those things to help with appetite reduction up in that area of the brain I was talking about. And then naltrexone, it's combined with naltrexone, sounds like something called naloxone, which is known as Narcan, right? Which you use for opioid overdoses. You guys, people might be familiar with that. And so naltrexone is an opioid antagonist. It's actually been approved for alcohol addiction to help people quit drinking alcohol. So now it starts to give you that idea that these different types of almost like neuroendocrine addiction things going on in the brain, right? And so when you combine those two things, it's a little bit synergistic. The naltrexone helps the bupropion work a little bit better. That specific medication is really good for people who have those strong cravings or that hedonic sort of food issue, kind of food addictions sort of thing. It's not the most efficacious straight up across the board, but people who have those types of symptoms and respond to it do pretty darn well. Those people end up getting more like 10, 11, you know, or more percent weight reduction, which is very meaningful. If you can imagine the people that you may be thinking about for it to be helpful for. And so that's still available. And then around the same time, there was the approval of one of the shots that we're going to end up talking more about, but it was a daily shot. Liraglutide is the generic name of it. And this is one of the GLP-1 receptor agonists that was approved for type 2 diabetes initially, because these mimic the intestine hormones, GLP-1 receptors, or GLP-1 that work on the GLP-1 receptors up in the area of the hypothalamus. They also slow down our gastric emptying, meaning it slows down our stomach. That's why you hear about people having like nausea and these very rare issues with like stomach paralysis now you've heard about because of the media, but that doesn't really happen. But they also work on the pancreas to help the pancreas work better and some other hormones like on the liver. So they're really, really, really good for type 2 diabetes. But part of the way they're really good for type 2 diabetes is they result in really good weight reduction. So that medication was approved at a higher dose. Victoza was the type 2 diabetes version. The higher dose called Saxenda was approved for obesity. And we were using a lot of that when I was still in fellowship at Walter Reed. Mm-hmm. And then more recently, in the past several years, the weekly versions of these types of medications have been approved for type 2 diabetes and then ultimately for obesity, regardless of diabetes status, with much more efficacy, meaning more weight reduction, better glycemic control in diabetes. And that gets us to Ozempic, which is semaglutide, a weekly shot that's indicated for type 2 diabetes. And then later on, at a little bit higher dose, called Wegovy for obesity. And actually, we finally got a cardiovascular outcome trial showing that it improves cardiovascular risk in those with obesity and heart disease. And then came the even slightly better GLP-1 GIP receptor agonist called tirzepatide. It was first approved as Mounjaro for type 2 diabetes, and then just recently approved for weight loss in the same exact dosing pattern as Mounjaro, known as Zepbound. And this one has the most weight reduction benefits that we've seen in any medication trial, getting into the 15, 20 or more percent weight reduction, getting close to like bariatric surgery for those with severe obesity.
Wow.
Now, I will say there's one other medication that has to do with those rare genetic diseases I mentioned earlier, that it kind of skips over some of those areas in the brain that are specifically dysfunctional, but I don't think anybody necessarily wants or needs to hear about that one. But that's,
Because it's interesting, and because I found it interesting as I was kind of researching some of this stuff, can you just quickly explain how Gila monsters factor into this conversation?
So that goes back to where how they first isolated one of these molecules, and that's what resulted in the first one available. So I was in medical school when I was doing some endocrine rotations when this was pretty new. That molecule is known as exenatide, and it was first approved for type 2 diabetes as Byetta, and then they did end up being able to make a weekly version of it called Bydureon. It hasn't had as much efficacy benefit for weight as much as like the liraglutide that came after it, and then the weekly shots, semaglutide and tirzepatide. So it hasn't been approved for obesity, although, it has its own benefits. I mean, they all have some benefits for that. They're better than a lot of other things. So that's where that came from. That's where they isolated it, many years ago now to start studying it.
I say that because as soon as people start Googling Ozempic, you're going to start seeing headlines like venomous lizard venom is good for weight loss. I mean, like it will.
Oh,
happen.
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
There's how the Gila monsters.
That's the story. Yeah.
I guess a logical next step here would be to talk a little bit about side effects. And then another piece I'm curious about, because this has come up a number of times when we've talked to folks, really a lot in sort of the veteran affairs space when we get into conversations around psychedelics for treatment and that sort of thing. But I think it might be relevant here too, which is just like the abuse of this type of stuff, because, you know, as it happens in the military, if some is good, more is better. You know, if I can, if I can lose 20% with this much, if I double it, you know, it'll be 40%. Can we walk through first some side effects and then maybe a quick touch on the conversation around abusing these types of things?
Yeah. So definitely don't take more than your physician suggests. There's a reason we have the dosing that we have, because that's what's been studied.
Oh, come on,
and
bro.
It's a balance of the benefits and risks. So all those medications specifically, the ones we're talking about, the injectables that have the most benefit for weight reduction, have a pretty common side effect of nausea. So a lot of people get some nausea. We have ways to keep the dietary intake light and a little bit lower fat. A lot of the things we try to do for their nutrition plan anyways will help sort of mitigate or prevent the nausea, or at least prevent severe nausea. You know, we tell people, hey, you know what, you might get some nausea. And if you can stay on the medication and weather that storm, that should probably go away. It's not the nausea that helps with the weight loss. That's been definitively shown. So the people who don't get nausea have the same amount of weight loss. However, if you might be a little bit more sensitive to it and have severe nausea and intolerance. We should be able to get most people to tolerate them if we start low, go slow, use smaller meals, avoid greasy restaurant type food, minimally processed food, that sort of thing. There's some other strategies too. There's some good guidance, that we have our dietitians help with patients. So nausea, vomiting, that's kind of the main thing. Other GI stuff can happen. Diarrhea or constipation, one way or the other, can happen for different people. Those are kind of the mainstays. There's not really a lot of other side effects from those. There was historically a concern of pancreatitis. That really has not borne out in the human big, huge trials, all the meta-analyses of these trials. Here and there, it maybe looks like there's a little bit of a risk, but they do have a slight increased risk of gallbladder issues in all these trials. And that can happen just from rapid weight loss, in addition to maybe having some biliary effect that you see. And then of course, gallstones can cause pancreatitis. So, there may be, a little bit of that there. Obesity and diabetes can also cause those issues as it is. And so it's kind of hard to differentiate. There was once, a strong concern of something called medullary thyroid cancer. It's a very, very rare type of thyroid cancer. Has to do with different types of cells in the thyroid. Because in rats, it looked like maybe there was a signal there. But they have different receptors on their thyroid cells, as it turns out. And so that has definitely not shown up in any of the human trials. And so, as an endocrinologist, I see people with thyroid cancer, so we're fairly keenly aware of that rare type. And that just is not actually a concern of mine. We still don't give it to somebody with thyroid cancer, like that type of thyroid cancer, though. People with kind of the run of the mill, the most common forms of thyroid cancer, it's not a problem there.
Sure. And as you're saying that, because you've kind of just walked through talking about greasy restaurants and all these kinds of things, like it's a pretty comprehensive treatment plan that I would imagine is multifactorial, multidisciplinary.
Should be.
So how do you, should be, right? Fingers crossed. But that's exactly my question. How do you map that onto an active duty soldier? And there's kind of two pieces to that. One is like, how can you exert that much control over a treatment plan of a patient who could just as well the next day be TDY somewhere with his buddies and, he stops at a greasy restaurant. Second piece of that is, given some of these triggers we talked about at the top of the episode, and given the conversations that seem to happen all the time about how a lot of those triggers are heightened in sort of a military setting, are there any additional like considerations that you think would need to happen in this? And maybe that goes back to the paper that you wrote. Just both of those questions may not be related at all, and that may have just become way too confusing, but hopefully it makes sense where I'm coming from with that.
Yeah. I mean, you're basically asking how to implement this, in a military setting and have it work well. It definitely needs to be a multidisciplinary thing. I think there needs to be more education. We have to have, and this goes to like everywhere. I mean, one of my passions is we have to get this whole concept of lifestyle medicine to be on the front lines of primary care in the medical world, but it really has to be kind of in the front lines, probably in the military world, not even associated with the medical portion of it. Right. So, on a ship, for example. So I had a little bit of experience on a ship. The the whole system has to be integrated to be healthy for people, right? Yeah, I mean, that's definitely something. Education and the support structure for people to have better nutritional options, education so that they can go and still enjoy themselves and personalize their own nutrition and diet and not be so stringent that they can't have any enjoyment, like not go out to eat all, you know, once in a while or have treats once in a while, but you know, have some education behind it so that at least they're making appropriate choices. You know, I always tell my patients, you know, one of the things that you'll hear about from people who really, really struggle with obesity is something this food noise, right? So we're talking about this being kind of a brain disease. And if you ever listen to somebody who has really struggled, but you know they were always, they knew what to do, but they were struggling to do it, and then they get onto one of these medications, they'll say, wow, yeah, now I don't have the food noise. Now I can do what I'm trying to do. But it's almost like, you know, the front part of your brain's that executive decision-making area, and all the rest of the brain was like overriding it. So, you know, if you're starving and you just can't help it, and there's all this available food that's overwhelming our energy balance, you know, people think it's someone's fault, but it's like, it's just not, it's hard. It's like an addiction, you know, to other things.
Yeah. So tying into the side effect stuff, I'll just ask one pretty specific one unique to kind of the stuff we do in the Army and all that kind of stuff. But how does being on some of these medications affect physical performance?
Yeah, that's a great question. So honestly, if they tolerate it, it shouldn't at all. You know, if they're having some nausea and vomiting on these medications specifically, well, that's going to be a problem. You know, if it were going to be, you know, I'm kind of thinking or talking out loud, right, as I think. So, you know, I'm thinking of athletes too, you know, if a military person was on these medications, it would have to be sort of titrated up to whatever the therapeutic dose was, make sure that it's benefiting the person and the person's tolerating it, and then go on and do their business. You know, move on. Same with any of the other pills I talked about, the Qsymia, the Contrave combination pills, because they have their own set of side effects too. But not anything more concerning than any other medications that people might need. You know, there are other concerns, you know, deploying to a literal war, right? Mm-hmm. You might not have access to these things. So then, you know, some of those other medications, you might have to have a plan to sort of wean off of them, as opposed to just stopping them cold turkey, just due to some of the other, you know, neurologic issues that can happen. But, you know, to some degree, if we can get people ready to go, and if we're, you know, really in a dire strait and people have to go to war, I think, you know, that's, we got bigger things to, you know, bigger fish to fry, and hopefully they'll be prepared. You know what I mean? And they're not going to suddenly have dramatic weight regain if they're in war. Now that gets a little out of my wheelhouse, right? I was military, but I was not in a war zone. So no, you know, I'm not trying to blow smoke up anyone's ass, right? That was not my thing. I was not infantry, right? I was not shooting a gun on a ship. I was the doctor, you know? So, you know, hopefully not so much of a pansy ass doctor, but I was still the doctor. You know what I mean? If I end up doing that stuff, we're in big trouble.
Hey, you are a doctor who lifts. Okay.
Exactly.
Clear. There you go. That puts you a cut above.
Yeah. And I was on I came out of retirement to be on the Navy's wrestling team at age 32. So
there you go.
You know, I can still fight just hand to hand, not Rambo.
So,
although I did think I was Rambo once when I had to go learn how to shoot a gun, and I actually did well with it. Then I said I was Rambo, but you still don't want me on the front lines.
So this one risks getting into a bigger conversation about like American laws around how we advertise medications and things like that. But I've bounced around the military a lot in my last couple jobs, and I've seen at least on two different Army installations, Ozempic being advertised directly to
You want to shout them out?
Yeah, shout out to Fort Campbell and Camp Humphreys for those. And it was a little bit shady. Like, you couldn't necessarily tell when you were looking at it.
Where was it advertising?
Yeah, and who was advertising it?
One of them was in the gym, one of them was in the dining facility.
Of course.
And it was like off-base clinics.
And that's the problem. Okay, I can't believe they let that happen. So here's one thing is that there is a decent chance they were not actually using the real medications.
Yeah, I heard about this. Where we get into compounding
pharmacies.
So don't let anybody sell anybody. I would strongly suggest to avoid those things. I don't know where they are, how they got them. You know, they're getting compounds from China made in their bathtubs, and now people are injecting them.
Can you explain compounding pharmacies real quick?
Because I'm not sure if I can.
I just learned about this.
So, compounding pharmacies, I was under the impression that they are beneficial when we need to come up with some sort of dose or way to give a type of medication to a patient, and they can take FDA approved available medications, often generic, and change them in such a way that we can do different doses that we think are appropriate for people. I talked to some of my ear, nose, throat surgeon friends, because I don't give any compounded medications, but they said they do sometimes because they got to get different antihistamines in the nose or something, you know, like stuff like that, where it's just not available in an FDA approved manner. So it was really confusing to me how these places were legally, and I'm not so sure it is legal, to get or to be able to say they are selling the compound in Ozempic. And that's what they say. So they'll say the same ingredient as Ozempic. Now, remember, Ozempic technically is only indicated for type 2 diabetes, mind you. So when people start saying that, you know, it's not really legitimate. Even though it's the same exact medicine, Wegovy is the one that's indicated for obesity. Ozempic is indicated for type 2 diabetes. Same medicine. Doctors may, you know, give one or the other, for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. But when they start advertising Ozempic for weight loss, that's a huge red flag of quackery, first of all. And I can't believe they allowed that in a military installation, especially for an off-base place. Oh. Now, if it was the clinic on base doing it, then they just need some education. And I feel like there would have been bigger issues there. But
there's a whole other podcast episode we could do on this one where I could go off the reservation a little bit. But the advertising on military bases flows through the morale, welfare, and recreation offices. Oh. And there's not really a lot of vetting. Like, I was just on Fort Carson last week working out in their gym, and there was an advertisement for predatory payday loans in the gym. Like, there's
no way
the stuff
horrible.
That's allowed to be advertised directly.
And you can get some Ozempic at the loan place.
That's pretty sad. I actually thought you were going to get into the United States, how we're one of two countries in the world that allows direct to consumer marketing.
That's
actual
what I'm thinking
medication.
About.
I heard about that. Let's do that.
I do have issues with that. I absolutely have issues with that. I think that's part of our problem, because why are and I'm, you know, this could get political, and this doesn't necessarily fit in line with kind of my sort of, you know, fiscally political sort of ideals personally. However, in this specific case, I don't understand how we allow pharmaceutical companies to spend millions and millions and millions of dollars advertising to patients who don't have the education to quite maybe grasp the nuance, just so they can go and ask their doctor for medications that it really should be the doctors that they're mm-hmm. advertising to anyways. But even then there's controversy. Like, so people, you know, they get worried about, you know, like, I don't mind. I love getting lunches from my drug reps, right? Like, I love the food, you know, but we are very hesitant to go do educational speaking, because if we get paid by pharma, then that looks bad. And a lot of physicians do. I actually think it's fine. I think we as physicians have to be cognizant of, you know, we need to be in charge of our own education. We can, you know, we should be involved, maybe work with pharma, et cetera. But the problem is, as it is right now, it looks bad, yet people are getting away with all sorts of way worse conflicts of interest. And I think part of it is the direct to consumer, you know, and then it makes the cost go up, right? So we also mm-hmm. have the highest cost for these medications that are really, really, really good for people, really for, you know, not necessarily people who shouldn't be on it, but these are important medications. And if we could have the cost go down in the availability, we'd be doing a lot better. But the cost is high, the coverage isn't that good, because the insurance companies would go broke. We have a very dysfunctional system, in case you haven't noticed. And it is. I actually rage against that machine. I do not agree with the direct to consumer marketing, let alone the sort of really obvious conflict of interest of selling BS compounded counterfeit molecules that who knows if they're safe. I don't know. Nobody
well,
knows.
I think what you just touched on there is exactly why my head has been where it's at in terms of the questions, I think, around sort of solving the obesity epidemic is because, again, being in the health and wellness space, you do deal with a lot of people who are overweight, who have been directly advertised to some sort of magic pill that's going to, you know, if I take this, I'm going to lose 50 pounds. And they go that route as opposed to investing time and energy into perhaps looking at their diet, looking at their, you know, daily movement levels. And I guess I say that because you do see, and again, you can totally shoot this in the face, but you see people who will make zero lifestyle changes whatsoever. They'll still eat the quadruple bypass burger, but because they're taking this pill that was directly advertised to them, like they're on this weight loss journey. I'm with you. Just, it adds a whole nother layer of
these flexing. Things are not mutually exclusive. Well, right. And you know, and then it goes for like supplements too, that have no real data. You know, I mean, I can't believe how much money the Golo people must be making to be able to advertise on TV. And, and yet they're like, that's not worth it. Like, if I were going to tell anybody to spend any money on anything, I'd tell them to spend money on something we know actually works and has some, you know, good safety data. Some of the ingredients in that, by the way, have been studied, but just like, you know, like, and then it's all combined together to do something. Anyways, yeah, absolutely. And yeah, we need to do better with educating people when they're using these medications too. So it all goes together. None of them are exclusive from each other.
Right.
So there's a few topics I want to move through a little bit quickly to get you out of here and respect your time over the holidays and stuff. But I do have one last question on the GLP-1s or the pharmaceutical approach to this and all this stuff is that in a lot of circles, and I think the military is certainly one of those circles, people portray turning to these medications as essentially failing at lifestyle interventions. What are your thoughts on that kind of dichotomy of if you're using drugs, you must have failed at everything else?
Some of it's semantics. So I actually don't like the term failed anyway. So a lot of insurance companies will actually say, oh, they must have failed 6 months of diet and exercise programming or whatever. And to be honest, most people, at least by the time they get to me or a specialist who does this stuff, they have been trying. I mean, it may not seem like it all the time, but they've generally almost always been trying somehow. So they haven't failed. They just haven't responded to. I like that term better. They have not responded to the nutritional exercise lifestyle efforts to result in a change in the energy balance and lose weight and get healthier, right? Mm-hmm. So that's what I would say for those semantics. Now, it depends on which way you're coming from that. So do you think are there people who say, oh, that means you didn't try or failed or you're cheating or something like that? I mean, that's also not true, because then they're kind of dismissing the biology that's actually is working against people. I mean, it really is. But yeah, we got to help people do better with the nutrition, educate and all that stuff. So that's why they're not mutually exclusive, you know.
Maybe this is a pivot. Maybe it's the sprinkles on top for folks that have made it this far listening to a conversation around, you know, sort of weight loss medication. But you're an endocrinologist. You're the first endocrinologist we've had on here. Congratulations. we gotta ask. TRT.
Yeah.
Testosterone replacement there. It's growing. Obviously, it's growing in popularity. What are your...
Well, okay. Well, here's the problem with that. And I have a very... As an athlete, former athlete, been lifting weights since I was a little kid. I was taking steroids when I was like 10 years old, pre-pubertal. And it's crazy.
Because you were jacked? Because you were shredded?
Yeah, I guess that I was. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think I still kind of am. Maybe not like I was back then. But So testosterone replacement therapy is absolutely appropriate for people who have clinically legitimate hypogonadism, meaning they have a hypothalamic pituitary injury, perhaps, that is causing them to not get the signal from their brain to pituitary to their testicles, and that's called a secondary hypogonadism. And so they have low testosterone, and that could be injury, tumors. It could be functional, meaning that we could treat the underlying issue, which is often obesity, sleep apnea, other medications, et cetera. So sometimes that will require some replacement therapy. Or if the testicles themselves have failed for, you know, whatever reason, whether it's trauma, surgery. I mean, we absolutely have our military veterans who have been injured in war, by the way, who maybe have been blown off and should not be, who have very legitimate traumatic brain injury, testicular injury, who they have hypogonadism. They have clinically legitimate low testosterone because of what we call organic disease. Something's not working and we can't fix it. They need replacement therapy. Mm-hmm. And we give them an appropriate dose. That's called testosterone replacement therapy. What you're actually, I think, asking about are the people out there who say they're taking TRT, but they're not. They'd have nothing to replace. They don't have a deficiency. They're taking steroids. They're taking anabolic steroids. If they're truly taking like appropriate doses that we would use for testosterone replacement therapy, then it's just kind of, then they're just taking medicine for no reason. Hmm. It may not even necessarily be harmful other than it's going to cause them to have hypogonadism. Because, you know, if you take testosterone, your hypothalamus, pituitary, and testicles don't have to work. That's why you always hear about guys who take steroids get shriveled testicles. Now, mm-hmm. the men's health clinics out there that sell these, by the way, so, you know, we have issues with, you know, obesity stuff out there, but there are men's health clinics that absolutely sell steroids. And then they sell all the other medications to go with it to try to mitigate the adverse effects of taking anabolic steroids. So they say, oh, everyone has to be on an aromatase inhibitor, which blocks the conversion of testosterone to estrogen, or they have to be on HCG, which is the pregnancy hormone that mimics one of our pituitary hormones that stimulates the testicles so they don't get testicular shrinkage, when in reality, most of those people don't need to be on testosterone. And if they do, if they truly do have hypogonadism and they're seeing someone like me, we're going to give them appropriate doses where they don't need those extra things. Mm. And so unfortunately, it's not like everyone is going out looking to try to be on steroids. This is another direct-to-consumer marketing thing from Big Pharma. And then all these kind of BS clinics got a hold of it. And it's always, I hate to say, it's always dudes that are, you know, they're taking steroids. And then they're saying, oh no, everyone has to be on TRT. All guys have to have testosterone of 900 or 1,000 or whatever. It's like, well, that's simply not true. We have the data. Everyone's different. Everyone has different testosterone fluctuations as long as there's not a true organic disease process. Mm-hmm. It gets complicated though. I mean, because we're talking about obesity, you know, so people with severe obesity, they can have hypogonadism. It's more of a functional hypogonadism though, just from the obesity. And if we treat the obesity, it gets better. We have lots of data for that, especially with like bariatric surgery from the past. Mm-hmm. Sleep apnea causes it. So we always want to treat the underlying root issue, not just give medicine. And that's what testosterone replacement therapy often, unfortunately, is. Or it's just unnecessary. People are just selling drugs and taking medicine they don't need, or taking too much. And if it's too much, then it's illegal anabolic androgenic steroids. It just simply is. I know people will end up hating me for that, but that's just haters going to hate. It drives me crazy, to be honest. But I get patients. I help people get off it all the time. I mean, there are people, guys referred to me who got duped. I've had a ton recently in the past couple of weeks, guys who were duped commercially to go to these places. And then they kind of realize, they're like, you know what? I think I'm taking steroids. They didn't want to. They just kind of got tricked into like, oh yeah, that sounds great. Better testosterone, you know? And now they're got to get off, and maybe they have fertility issues now. Yeah, yeah. Trying to help them fix them.
You've touched on two topics I was thinking about going into the TRT conversation. And one is kind of the underlying cause issue, where I think mm-hmm. a lot of military members who are interested in this kind of stuff are also dealing with like sleep deprivation, poor mm-hmm. nutrition, high stress, yeah. all the things that are like high on the list of underlying yeah. causes for that kind of issue. Mm-hmm. To some degree, I kind of understand that like the lives they live may make changing those things difficult, but I think there's a conversation there too. But yeah. you mentioned specifically helping guys get off of it after they've been duped into it with the mm-hmm. the low T ads and things like that.
Yeah.
Can you help me understand a little bit? Because I've heard people talk about how like if you go on exogenous testosterone, you kind of have to stay on it because it inhibits natural production of testosterone. So you're kind of stuck on it for long term. Like it sounds like you've got solutions there.
But you don't have to. I mean, not necessarily. I mean, you know, there are definitely some people, I have some patients who, you know, maybe took steroids when they were younger. And boy, it's hard. I have probably at least one or two guys where it's like, you know, they just feel like garbage every time we try to get them off. We use some of these other medications to help stimulate their testicles and their axis, their pituitary testicular axis work better. And they just can't. And they do end up on like reasonably appropriate dosed testosterone replacement therapy, right? But a lot of people can get off of it. It's, you know, it takes work, it takes effort, you know, and it takes some of these other medications to help try to support the system. It takes nutrition, exercise, good sleep, not over restriction. You know, for example, I wrestled in college, you know, and if you guys know much about that, you know, we get really, really low body fat. We cut weight. Mm-hmm. I guarantee if someone would have checked all of us and we're like, you know, talk about like Division I level, like fighters, right? We don't have hypogonadism. But if you would have checked us when we're cutting weight, I guarantee it would have been lower. I mean, I definitely remember cutting weight and being, you know, in hindsight, like having a pretty low libido for a 22-year-old, right? But then, you know, yeah, you get over it and then everything gets functional. You get enough adipose tissue, you eat well, you get enough sleep, stress reduction, and, you know, and things recover a little bit. The same sort of thing we got to do for anybody who has, you know, who's been on this stuff. A lot of times people recover.
Mm.
It just sometimes takes some effort, but not always. Not always.
I want to work towards a close by talking a little bit about, or I guess just kind of giving you the floor to talk a little bit about mm-hmm. lifestyle medicine, because, and again, speaking specifically about the Army, but more broadly, the military, with this idea of embedded human performance and starting to look at what role does strength and conditioning play? What role does injury prevention play? What role does dietetics play? Like, how do all these things blend together into a traditional military medical model to create, you could argue, a lifestyle medicine environment? So given that that's kind of your expertise, what does that mean to you?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it's not just military. I mean, we have to find a better way to get people doing basic nutrition, education, and exercise. Not everyone has to be a high-level athlete.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go to the military, we want our war fighters to be the top level guys. Now that could also, we could get some controversial discussions from some people on, well, maybe they should be the ones who are super enhanced with, you know, hormones or something like that. I don't know morally, because I don't think we should do harm to people. And to me, that would be harmful for people, but that's a whole nother controversial debate that somebody else can have, I guess. You know, from a moral perspective, if that was what people decided, I would be okay with it because they're protecting us, right? I like, that's a whole totally different level. But we want everyone in the military to be healthy,
mm-hmm.
even if they're not the true war fighters, you know, the doctors, the lawyers, the nurses, everyone else. So I think not only does that need to be in the front lines of primary care, like I say, everywhere in the medical field, but it really needs to be in the front lines of all military personnel within, you know, on ships, in your, what do you call it in the Army? What kind of, you know,
tanks, Humvees,
you know, if in your ship, yeah, like your infantry units and whatnot, you know,
The tips of the spear.
These need to be not even just in medicine, right? So military medicine can only do so much. This needs to be pushed forward onto the front lines of everybody, every single person, leadership down to the, you know, the newly enlisted in the military, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It just needs to be a bigger global effort from big military. I think, you know, we spend a lot of money on stuff. I know people know that. There's, you know, I think maybe we need to, you know, shift some priorities here and there.
So Drew said we're moving towards the close. I do want to give you a chance to talk. You and your brother are the docs who lift, right? And I want to give you a chance to talk about why, given all the stuff we've just talked about, both of your backgrounds in medicine, why do you guys prioritize resistance training that way?
Well, one, because that's what we like to do growing up. So I got into lifting when I was a little kid. You know,
who's my dad stronger?
Pound for pound, I'm definitely stronger. Nice. He did surpass me at some point. I'm short. He's tall. He wrestled heavyweight. I was a middleweight. I did win a couple state championships in powerlifting in high school. He didn't do that. He would have been good at that too if he would have done it, like especially as a senior, I think. But we could debate that. Now we're getting old and stuff doesn't work that well. We don't do a lot of math.
Hey, you should take testosterone.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, the people out there be like, oh, you should take growth hormone too, but it's, don't do that either. Jeez. But, you know, so we enjoyed lifting weights and it was, you know, we did it for sport. And as we got older in medicine, you know, it was very important for health and certainly people need to do aerobic exercise too. It's very important, but it's almost amazingly become even more important in the specialty that we've gone down in obesity and cardiometabolic medicine, because as we do all these different things to help people with their nutrition and weight loss, their health is going to improve. But, you know, those medications we were talking about, some people are like, oh my gosh, they're losing so much weight, they're going to lose muscle. Well, we don't want people to lose muscle. So we got to prioritize the weight training. That is the key to maintaining muscle when you are losing weight. And muscle is healthy. Mm-hmm. Every single study ever done on muscle, the more muscle is metabolically healthy, unless you take steroids to do it, right? But it also is important for so many other things. Quality of life, physical function, being able to play with your grandkids, osteoporosis, which is bone density, fragility, risk of fracture, and it's good for bones. If you have less risk of a fall, you won't break your bones when you get older. If you get sick, you have an easier way to recover. You have less risk of getting sick. Just so many things that resistance training is important for. And I just don't think enough people know enough about it to do it. And again, it doesn't have to be crazy. I tell all my patients, you can do the most simple, boring stuff if we go to a gym or we set you up at home to do some pushing, pulling stuff and some leg exercises. It doesn't have to be crazy. People don't have to look like me or be an elite athlete, right? They just need to do it a little bit and have some basics, and they'll be so much better off for it. And this is, talk about cradle to the grave. We did a podcast with a friend, a trainer who's a football player who kind of turned into a real, you know, resistance training guy last year. And we just talked about why it's so important for resistance training from cradle to grave. I don't care how young or old you are. You need to do something to start building your muscle a little bit if you haven't already. So yeah, that's kind of why that's kind of our, yeah, we're shills for weight training for sure. Strength training. And anyway,
there you go. I don't know if anybody from weight training is paying for your lunches though.
I was going to say big weight.
Well, big gym. Maybe we can get Gold's Gym to give me some lunch or something.
There you go.
Sponsor our podcast episode sometime.
Oh man.
I just want to say thanks for coming on. And before we let you go, obviously I've been a fan of DoxyLift for a long time, gotten a lot of good information from you guys. Where can people find you if they want to listen to your stuff, find more information?
Yeah. So the DoxyLift podcast, it's on Spotify and Apple and all the things. Social media, I'm just Dr. Carl Nadolski, DRKARL Nadolski, and you know, even do a little TikTok here and there. I'm not big on that. That drives me crazy, actually. But
I haven't gotten there yet.
I advertised our most recent podcast episode today on TikTok, but you know, Instagram, Twitter, all that stuff. So.
Cool. Awesome. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Hey, Alex, let's cover our ass real quick.
Oh, great idea, Drew. All right, guys. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode. Before you go, please rate and review the pod on the listening platform of your choice. You can also visit us on our website at www.mopsinmos.com. That's mops, the letter N, mos.com. You can check out the library of podcast episodes, our latest blog entries, any helpful resources, and also sign up for our newsletter.
Drew nailed it. Just to underline a couple of things, the podcast entries have in-depth show notes on the website. So if you missed anything or you want to read any of the research we talk about, it is all there. You can, at the bottom of the website, sign up with your email and receive future updates from us. The blog posts go a little bit more in depth in kind of written form on a couple of topics we get questions about all the time. But most importantly, I just want to ask all you guys, our best way the word gets out is absolutely word of mouth. So tell your friends, tell the people you work with, anybody you think would find it useful. Thanks for spreading the word.
If you have any questions or comments, feel free to shoot us an email at either Drew or Alex at mopsandmos.com.
Or there's a contact form on the website.
Thank you.